Hi, I'm Sam Cedar. This week on Ring of Fire, Jason Leopold from BuzzFeed News will join us to unpack an expose he wrote detailing how dirty money flows through the world's biggest banks and why the government can't seem to stop it or won't seem to stop it. Heather Digby Parton will join me to help run down the news of the week. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor, support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member over at rofpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon, the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, we had, just before we go on and start talking about these things, you and I usually touch base for a minute or two and mention some of the top stories that we want to hit. It's almost like, athletes warming up before they go out and play, whatever it is they're about to play. And we do that, too, just limbering up a little bit. And we were going over four of the big stories this week, the debate. Amy Coney Barrett she had not been officially named by the when we spoke last week. We sort of anticipated it, but she is the Supreme Court nominee. And this week, there's some stories involving her that aren't terribly surprising, but make the whole thing that much more explicit. James Comey testified in front of the Senate this week. And, of course, we have this huge revelation, and this has been sort of an ongoing story for probably about 5 years. We see, or I should say the New York Times have seen, Donald Trump's taxes and reveal, at the very least, much of what we suspected in terms of his tax obligations and how he has fulfilled them, and very, very well possibly setting him up for some post-presidential criminal charges in terms of representing to one entity, like people he's trying to get a loan from, that he is of a certain amount of value, and other entities, like the U.S. government, that he's of a different value in terms of what his assets are. We'll talk about that. But the amazing thing as we were talking about this was, 4 or 5 years ago, any one of these stories in the context of talking about the president and talk about a presidential race, we would have talked about that for the entire hour. And we would have been like, we barely did that any justice. Now it feels like all these stories are huge. Where's the fifth story? Because, these things we tend to now blow through them because there's so much news. And in some respects, they don't drop as hard because there's been so much news. I mean, you and I remember the era where, people on the nominal left were being recruited to protect Barack Obama from charges that he wore a tan suit. And that went on for, 2 weeks or something. And we weren't literally recruited. I'm being a little bit facetious, but not too facetious. Right. I mean, that was a huge scandal. That he wore a tan suit at one point. I can't even remember the context. Maybe we're at the end of this era of this type of news cycle, within the next 3 or 4 months, inshallah, as Biden said during the debate. Give me your sense of where we're at, because, what are the questions that people always ask when they start to talk about analyzing, particularly, not so much the primary debates, because I think those are clearly important. But presidential general election debates, like, do they matter? Are they going to change anything? And my answer for this is no and yes. Like, who knows? It's impossible to tell. And on some level, it's like, does anything matter anymore?
Well, you're right. And I mean, that's sort of an ongoing meme, isn't it? Nothing matters, because it does seem that we're in this kind of, perpetual motion machine with one thing after another sort of coming at us, and just kind of, we just have to keep moving and just keep going through it. And I hate to sort of be the bearer of bad news here, but I think that the next month until the election is going to be worse than anything we've ever seen. I think we're going to be in the middle of a, you know, of a hurricane of news and scandal and every kind of crazy, political machination that we can imagine, because we're already seeing this, and debates were just one part of it. I mean, did debates matter? You know, the historical, evidence is that they don't really make that much difference in the election. I mean, there's some people who think that the Michael Dukakis gaffe, in which he didn't get emotional when asked what he'd do if his wife were raped. And, there have been moments, there's always these moments in debates, but whether or not they make a difference, and of course it's very hard to measure that. But just looking back at 2016 and sort of narrowing it down to Donald Trump, I went back and did a piece looking at the debates in 2016, and Hillary Clinton massively cleaned his clock, according to the public, in those debates. She was ahead, 30-some points in the public after the first one, the second one a little bit less, the third one she blew him out of the water. It was just, this is part of what gave people this kind of complacency about her winning, was the idea that, look, everybody's seen them together. We've seen what happens. We've seen that he's a barbarian and an ignoramus. And now, of course, everybody's going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Well, we know how that turned out. She did not win by 30 points, and she won, the popular vote, and then was barely edged out in three states in the Electoral College. So I don't think, anyone should count on anything and count on the debates changing the dynamic in some way, regardless of whether or not Trump makes a fool of himself and be an embarrassment in front of the world as he was on Tuesday night. But I, like you, yes, they do matter. I mean, they matter just because, it's important to see these people in action. It's important for the country. It's important for democracy. And I've always felt the debates were a good thing. But I am beginning to wonder whether or not this particular series of debates is good for democracy. I mean, I'm starting to, I'm on the fence on this. There's a part of me that says they should just cancel them. Because it's people like, I have a friend who's got, a couple of kids, and he was embarrassed to have his kids watching that. Yeah. Felt that behavior was just awful, and it was, they were seeing something that was really destructive to them, to see someone in that position of authority behaving that way. I mean, that goes way beyond any of the sort of Clinton, what do we tell the children? Because right. That was, that did not happen on national TV in front of 65 million people.
Right.
This happened right in front of everybody. So there's a part of me that thinks that it's not such a great idea to keep them going. But I don't think there's any chance they'll cancel them. They're going to go ahead. And Biden certainly can't back out, or they'll call him a chicken. So he has to do it. And Trump doesn't seem to be inclined to cancel, because he likes the attention no matter what it is.
And he's behind.
He understands.
And he's behind. I mean, so let me just offer one amendment / correction to what you said. You say the next month is going to be worse than anything we've seen. I'm going to suggest to you that the next 2 months are going to be worse than anything we've seen.
Agreed.
Because it's going to go past, I think it's going to go past November 3rd, that level of insanity. In fact, it could be even more intense on November 4th. I would also add that, as we were talking about this, it is indicative of the time. It is indicative of this entire era, frankly, that we also neglected to factor in this notion of over 200,000 Americans have died. We're up now nearly 210,000 Americans. We are looking at increases across the country, particularly in the Midwest. It's explosive in South Dakota, the COVID. We're starting to see things tick up just a little bit in New York. There are all sorts of, we've got a lot of difficulty, frankly, with the COVID. And, part of that was the backdrop to the debate. The one thing I think that is the case with the debates that, and again, I think the scholarly data says there's no indication that debates matter, which isn't to say that they don't matter. It's simply to say that you cannot necessarily parse out how it impacts the race. And my sense is that debate last night could be, and again, I would say in terms of like the impact on the vote in and of itself, I think it's probably immeasurably small. But again, like you mentioned, Hillary Clinton lost the vote with 0.058% of the vote. I did that math myself. We're talking 70,000 votes over the course of three states when about 120 million votes were cast. And so infinitesimally small differences could make a very big difference in terms of the future of the country. And the one thing that I think happened at this debate, because usually, you know, you do a debate, you do debate assessment, and we would have three or four moments that we would talk about. And or we would have, you know, I'd run tape from, oh, this is the exchange, and here's where this person was lying, or this person was fudging, and this is why they didn't mention this aspect of that policy, because it has this effect in that area. Completely, that would be a completely useless exercise.
Forget about it.
It would be virtually impossible. I mean, I do have a couple of like sort of things I wish Joe Biden either said or had the ability to say. But the big thing that came out of this, I think, was that both candidates, to a large extent, played directly into their narratives that have been developed. Like, you know, I can't tell you, like, to me, the narratives about Trump and Clinton, she may have cleaned his clock in those debates, but I don't think, you know, in looking back, if I think about what the narratives were for that debate, right? I mean, broadly speaking, in terms of what ultimately impacted the election, it was Clinton perceived by enough people that she would either not represent meaningful change or had corruption problems, right? And I don't want to litigate those, you know, those attributes, but those were the narratives that were out there that I think, you know, fundamentally impacted her vote. And that Donald Trump was a joke or you know, was a bigot. And I don't think those debates furthered those as much. I think it was really more like Hillary Clinton came off as more competent. And Donald Trump came off as, you know, sort of a little bit petulant. And those weren't the sort of the primary narratives, I think, of this of that election. The primary narratives of this election are Donald Trump is completely is rogue in many respects, right? Mm-hmm. Rogue mm-hmm. as to the sort of ideals Perfect. Of America and rogue in terms of the ideals of governance. And Joe Biden is a guy who's lost a step, but is fundamentally a decent guy. You know, maybe you agree with him, maybe you don't. Maybe you have problems with him from the right. Maybe you have problems with him from the left. But more or less, you think he's a fundamentally decent guy who is, you know, going to, at the very least, stop the bleeding. And I think both those narratives were demonstrable and paramount in that debate last night. Donald Trump came off as a completely out of control lunatic who had total disregard for the American people, for the moderator, for his opponent, for everything they were even discussing. And Joe Biden came off, in my mind, as a guy who's lost a step, but was just trying to, you know, do a normal debate and you know, was getting a little bit fed up. And I feel like that was it. That, you know, end of story. There was nothing else that took place in that debate. I think, you know, I don't know how anybody could walk away with any other sense of that debate. And on some level, I wonder if that doesn't make it actually have more impact because you don't get any more rudimentary than that.
Right. I mean, I would even go so far as to say that it really wasn't even about Biden's decency. Just it's rogue and not rogue.
Right,
you know,
right,
it's,
right.
There's this guy who's trying to break everything, and he is setting out, he cares nothing for any kind of you know, normal, you know, norms, rules, laws, anything. He is 100% rogue. And here's this other guy who isn't. He plays by the rules. He follows the normal, you know, sort of way that we look at our American government. Hey, our American society. I mean, Trump does and says things that aren't even political, that are rogue. I mean, these aren't, he is abnormal in that sense in, yep. in every way. So that's really, I think you're right. And there seems to be a group of people, white, you know, mostly middle-aged and older, although he does have his youthful followers as well. And this group of people apparently is, you know, sees this rogue president as their avatar. I mean, they see this as, I mean, it's almost as if, and I've thought a little bit about this, that there's a baby boomer psychology here, which I can speak to because I am one. The, you know, there's a certain group that experienced this in their youth, right? You know, bring down the state. Hey, you know, the shit's coming down. I mean, there was that whole kind of ethos that went on in the 60s and early 70s. At that time, those people, there was another side to that, which you can see illustrated in like Rick Perlstein's book, Nixon Land. There were a lot of conservative young people. And it's a huge generation, right? I mean, the baby boom, it was gigantic. And a big part of it was conservatives. They're having their Woodstock, they're having their anti-war, they're having their counterculture now. And Donald Trump is their Abbie Hoffman, you know. He's like this complete disturber who's trying, and they're sort of living out that kind of you know, anti, you know, counterculture sort of lifestyle, and certainly on a political level now. And so that thing that really appeals to them, there's this whole group of Americans there, and they I think they used to call themselves conservatives, and they're not anymore. And so, you know, we're watching it. Okay, that's fine. But what I don't get, and I will never understand, or maybe I understand too well, is there's a whole Republican Party. That those are people who are not in that. They are not, I mean, I shouldn't say all of them. There are some who are in part of Donald Trump's personality cult. But for the most part, these are people who are just cynical opportunists, who are using this, using Donald Trump, using this phenomenon to further goals that they cannot achieve by any normal democratic means, because they just don't have enough people behind them to do it. So they are using this disruption, this chaos, this rogue president to achieve goals that they were unable to achieve otherwise. And that is the real fundamental problem here. And I don't think debates or anything like that changes that. I mean, Donald Trump is sitting atop this you know, edifice, this remaining edifice of the Republican Party, and they are underneath it all doing all this stuff, and we can talk about that, all the things that are going on behind the scenes, Amy Coney Barrett being one of them, isn't exactly behind the scenes, but that's right. Going on underneath this whole thing with Donald Trump and his craziness. So, you know, we watch that debate, and I'm horrified, and I'm embarrassed for my country. I'm embarrassed for my species to see that kind of thing. It's absolutely ridiculous and very frightening, considering that the you know, America has the most powerful military on earth. We have more nuclear weapons than anybody on the planet. We are, and the, you know, the whole world is pegged to our economy, and, you know, this is what we're showing as leadership. I mean, it's pathetic, really, and it's very scary. If I were a foreigner, I'd be going, you know what, maybe we need to back off from these people a little bit. You know, hey, you know, Xi Jinping, you know, you got a minute? Let me talk to you, because these people over here have completely lost their minds. And that's a very scary thing, and that's sort of what we were seeing in that debate, and nothing in it of any substance. Aside from one thing, and you said that nothing really happened, I do think there's one thing that did happen. It crystallized, I think, hopefully for more people, that Trump plans to disrupt the election. I just don't think there's any doubt about it. And I think, you know, as you said, we're going to have, you know, this is going to be churning after Election Day. And he made that pretty clear, I think. And his call to arms to the Proud Boys, that sort of thing. I mean, even if he did it without really realizing what he was doing, and I do think he knew who the Proud Boys were. They're Roger Stone's personal bodyguard. So right. I think Trump knew very well who they were. But, you know, he that whole aspect of it, I think, crystallized a bit, mostly because the media, you know, jumped on it. There were a million things they could have jumped on, but that was the thing that they saw. And I think that maybe people are starting to wake up to the fact that Donald Trump has really, you know, he said it's not going to end well. And that was his, you know, he was making a promise, not a prediction. OK, I mean, it's not going to end well. So that part of it. And of course, that fits with the rogue presidency, too. We've never had a president behave this way, you know, so this is a totally new thing.
Well, first off, I think your the theory you have about this is the other half of the boomers finally having their chance to rebel against the establishment. And it's sort of almost like an arrested development type of situation, or maybe just a some type of delayed, teen years or something to that effect, I think is fascinating, frankly. And I think that's I certainly know some type of, like, there is a libertarian strain of hippies who are now older, who, you know, did not subscribe to sort of the emancipatory movements of black people and of women and of gay people and are seeing Trump as a vehicle to sort of live out their own protest. I think that's fascinating. It had never really occurred to me in that respect. And I would agree with you. The things that stuck out for me were exactly that, what you said about that moment with the Proud Boys. I mean, important, if only, I mean, I don't know how many people, you know, it changes their opinion of it, but the one thing that I think is really important is that the mainstream media, the media now has Donald Trump mentioning the Proud Boys in a very well publicized and covered moment. And if the Proud Boys start to do something, and this is something you and I have been talking about, I feel like I say these words every week now that we've been talking about for months, this scenario where the Brooks Brothers riot happens in Michigan and it happens in Wisconsin and it happens again, maybe in Florida or in Pennsylvania. And instead of guys wearing suits, instead of, you know, lawyers in their, 10 p.m. at night, I'm in the conference room with a bunch of other lawyers, look to them, they're going to be Proud Boys who are going to interfere with the counting of ballots in the days following the election, particularly these mail-in ballots. This is something that is, you know, at least part conjecture and then part, you know, sort of, you know, adding up a little bit of the pieces of evidence that are out there. And we should remind people that Roger Stone was in a van down the street. I mean, he was coordinating a lot of that Brooks Brothers riot. So this is, you know, this is an old playbook for him. And if that starts happening, if there are reports from, I don't know, outside of Milwaukee or, you know, reports in some county in Michigan that it's Proud Boys who are assembling and interfering with this, it is not going to be. There is no learning curve for the media in that moment as to understand what's going on. That when was the last time we heard the word Proud Boys? It was out of the president's mouth at the debate, and he had told them to stand by, you know, hurry up and wait type of situation. And so I think that's very effective. And then I think the other thing, you know, like you say, I think it was really just more about like rogue, not rogue. I think there was some missed opportunities by Joe Biden. And, you know, I don't want to get nitpicky here. I think on the night of the debate, I basically said, like, it's very hard to watch this as someone who was a supporter of not Joe Biden's in the primary and not sort of imagine, you know, Bernie Sanders up there with Donald Trump or Elizabeth Warren up there with Donald Trump. Or even, and I would say I would probably prefer Biden over Amy Klobuchar, but it's even hard to imagine, like, you know, Amy Klobuchar, up there, that they wouldn't have been able to sort of at least articulate some things, you know, to get a little bit of a narrative going there beyond the rogue. For instance, Donald Trump And this was a story that broke this week, and I think we're going to see more drip, drip, drip of this story a little bit because those taxes probably have a lot of information there that are that is relevant. Donald Trump didn't pay taxes for the better part of a decade. To the extent that he did, he paid like $750 in federal income taxes. And we know that that Donald Trump back during the debates with Hillary Clinton said, that's because I'm smart. And we know that when Joe Biden brought it up the other night, he said, well, you made the tax laws. Well, Joe Biden could have really, I mean, this is something that was completely predictable, his, you know, Trump's response, could have just simply said, you know, you said you were smart because you're not paying taxes and because those are the laws. So when you say that, you're saying that the construction worker who's paying more in taxes than you, that he's a sucker. And when you say that you're smart, you're saying that the teacher is a sucker and the cop is a sucker and the fireman is a sucker and the clerk at the supermarket is a sucker and the doctor's a sucker. And you're saying everyone in this audience, they're suckers and you're the smart one. And when it came time for you to sign a bill to change the taxes, you said, I'm still the smart one and they're still the suckers. Like, that's it. That's all Joe Biden had to say. And he definitely tried to say something like that, but he could not. And, you know, it is what it is. And again, I'm quite convinced that all things being equal, Joe Biden walks away with there and his staff has to say, we'll take it. You know, we'll take it. Definitely. But there is a quality of everything that is going on now. And it's incumbent upon those of us who really want to see some real change to seize this moment if Joe Biden becomes president. But there really is a like a sense of just massive missed opportunity here, both from an electoral standpoint in terms of like, you know, the debate, but also in terms of just like, you know, the country is in a position where certain things are clearly obvious. We have a broken healthcare system. You know, and I'm quite convinced that most of the congresspeople and senators out there who are running or challengers, they're talking about health care. Joe Biden can't talk about health care, really, in many respects. He can talk about what Donald Trump is doing to it, but he can't talk about what he's going to do. I mean, that is Joe Biden's campaign is designed to avoid a need for any type of positive, you know, proactive action. It is all, I'm going to stop the bleeding and making it a referendum of Donald Trump. And that, you know, we've said this in the past before, too. That's all well and good as long as you don't have any outside factors that call upon you to have an answer for things. And, you know, during the debate, Joe Biden said the Green New Deal will pay for itself, but I'm not for it. I mean, this is, you know, it keeps it in the realm of a referendum on Donald Trump. But, it you know, there's going to be stuff to do after the election is won. And I understand how the sequence works here. But it is there is a sense of like, would it really be that bad to have a president articulate a vision for the future that goes beyond absence of Donald Trump?
Oh, it would be great to have that. And, you know, I felt the same way watching it, you know, going and even Joe Biden, I was thinking, gosh, you know, I if only it was the Joe Biden of 2008, you know, who made the zinger, you know, not a noun, a verb, and 9/11, right? I mean, that's one of the great debate moments that, you know, one of the best zingers anybody's ever had. And it may be the thing that has made Rudy Giuliani, you know, turn Joe Biden into his great white whale, right? Yeah. Because he's seeking revenge for that particular moment. Rudy Giuliani was a front runner at that time for the Republican convention. So I think that, you know, the Joe Biden of then would have been much better than the Joe Biden of today. And yeah, I don't think, you know, look, I think every Democrat is kind of sitting there going, oh, okay, you know, I mean, it's all right. You know, if this is what we're doing, let's do it. You know, he's a decent man. He's not rogue. you know, whatever. And of course, it would be great to, you know, have this be a moment of inspiration. But I can't, forget that, you know, when Barack Obama ran in 2008 and he had massive, you know, adulation on the part of the left. And I remember watching this, I imagine you do too, watching that and going, wait a minute, this guy's not really that left. I mean, this isn't really an agenda about, you know, a real progressive change. It's more about, you know, aspirational generational change and things like that, all of which are really potent things in an election. But as far as getting those kind of specifics, you know, it was pretty thin in a lot of ways. And he was running that same kind of thing and in a much different way than Joe Biden is doing, and a much more effective way, I will say. But I think that maybe this is something that, you know, you and I are yearning for. And I don't know if we're ever going to get it in a campaign where somebody just is able to run just full out. Maybe we're changing, and maybe the next time, you know, whoever the next person is will be able to do that. I don't know. But, you know, that doesn't mean, and I just didn't want to make one small point about Biden that I think is kind of interesting, because he had no problem saying, I won't vote for I'm not for the Green New Deal. I've got my own plan. He had no problem saying, yes, I believe in law and order, you know, and justice, or however he's framing
more,
it.
More
and,
cops, right?
You know, yeah, I mean, he was, you know, cops, there are a lot of good cops, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, he wasn't afraid to do that as far as going against, you know, sort of left-wing, you know, Black Lives Matter style priorities in that debate, but that he is refusing to say anything about, you know, expanding the Supreme Court or ending the filibuster. And I find that really fascinating. Now, a lot of people say that just means he's just, you know, trying to evade the question. But why? Why evade the question? This is Joe Biden. You know, I know these people. He could say, you know, I'm going to bring everybody together. The Republicans and I are great friends. He's not saying that anymore. He did in the primaries. He's not saying it now. And I just have a feeling that when it comes to this process, that they've looked around at the Democratic Party and see that every faction, from the left to the right, understands that this fundamental assault on democracy that Mitch McConnell and the Federalist Society and the Republican Party in general, and what they're planning to do in this upcoming election, they're fanning out with lawyers all over the country, getting ready to challenge, you know, legitimate ballots. You've got Governor Abbott today just saying he's closing most of the satellite offices for drop-off mail-in ballots. No reason, just he's going to do it. So now they're just, you can only have one in every county. And, you know, Texas counties are big, right?
Yeah.
So let's ask somebody to drive 100 miles to drop off their mail-in ballot. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I think maybe has become obvious to even the most staid and ossified Democrat, the Chris Coons of the party.
Yes.
or the Joe Bidens of the party, for that matter. That, you know, they're looking at this and going, we have got a serious problem. Because, by the way, and I know I keep saying this, but I think it's so important, this isn't Donald Trump. It's not even his voters. We've discussed them, you know, these weird, you know, hippie baby boomer old people, right-wing hippie baby boomer old people. But it is the Republican Party itself has gone rogue. It has gone
absolutely
completely rogue.
Absolutely, without a doubt.
And this is something that I think maybe, just judging by this one situation where Biden is refusing to confront this directly in the election, which he could do if he wanted to, I think maybe they're seeing the light here a little bit. I'm hoping, and if they aren't, you know, we have to push it as hard as we can, because this assault on democracy is an existential threat. It really is. I mean, we've got a big, big problem. And that's not just Donald Trump. You've got, you know, I mean, Marco Rubio, Tom Cotton. You've got all these people out there defending this stuff.
Well,
Governor,
I mean,
Abbott in Texas. They're doing it. So, you know,
I mean,
need to face the music.
I mean, so 2 points there. In terms of, like, the Republicans, I mean, let's not forget that Paul Ryan was throwing his voice in on the chorus of things like, these ballots coming in from California are very suspicious.
Yep.
Very suspicious, he said. I mean, that laid the groundwork for everything that we're seeing now with this mail-in ballots. And people should not forget that. Paul Ryan, who was the darling of the Beltway media elite, and not so elite, frankly, and this guy was using his credibility to promote these exact same things. I mean, that, you know, and you could say he didn't believe it, but I mean, does it make a difference? Does it really make a difference? I mean, you know, this is what it led to. And so I that's just to reiterate, you know, the point about the Republicans. And this the other point is, I think you're absolutely right. I think that there is, I think the Democrats, I don't know that they're, you know, locked and loaded for this, but the idea of statehood for D.C., the idea of giving giving the opportunity for statehood for D.C., which I think they would take, giving the opportunity for statehood to Puerto Rico, which I'm not 100% sure that they would take, but giving them the opportunities, and then reforming the Supreme Court in maybe multiple different ways, I think it's on the docket. And now, with that said, it makes me a little bit concerned about you know, how much flexibility and wiggle room there is on these other issues that I care deeply about. You know, so like when he says no Green Deal, he means it. When he says, you know, no Medicare for all, he means it. Now, how much wiggle room there is, I don't know. But clearly, he doesn't want to be their campaign again is no positive agenda. And to the extent that that manifests itself when they actually do have any type of positive agenda, it is do not commit to it. Right. I mean, that is the way he is expressing a positive agenda. And that is, I won't answer that question. One can hope. Chris Coons was signaling about 6 months ago that he was open to filibuster reform. It seems impossible. And to be fair, we saw this week that there was that they were having trouble, the Republicans, getting quorum in the Judiciary Committee to rubber stamp some more federal judges. Now, my message to Chuck Schumer is dollar short, day late.
Yeah, no kidding.
And Schumer forced a vote on the ACA this week, which would be a good messaging vote. My response to that is also dollar short, day late. But I'll take it. But I want to remind people that what Chuck Schumer is also illustrating for all of you is that he could have been doing things a lot differently. And so we will see how they handle these hearings. I mean, I think that's probably what you and I are going to be talking about the most. The most that next week is, you know, what should they be doing? They're already not meeting with Amy Coney Barrett. Adam Gentilson, the former chief of staff of Harry Reid, has sort of outlined what you could do. You could refuse to do unanimous consent for every vote. You could refuse to show up and make all the Republicans fulfill the obligations of quorum. 51 senators need to be there. About half a dozen to a dozen of those Republican senators are desperately wanting to be on the campaign trail. There's only one or two, maybe Democrats, who are in any way threatened with losing their seat. And so that would have benefit to building a Democratic Senate. And it would also slow everything down, because the name of the game now is exact as high a political price.
Yes.
For Amy Coney Barrett sitting on that court. You're not going to stop her, I don't think. But you must exact the highest possible political price for seating her. And that includes, A, make it harder for them to campaign. Maybe they lose more seats because of it in the Senate. B, you also, if you can push it into the lame duck, you're going to build the strength to reform the Supreme Court. It is one thing to, you know, ram Amy Coney Barrett through there before the election. It is a very different thing to ram her through with senators who are not going to be seated in 30 days for a president who will not be the president in 30 days. That is very different, I think, in terms of the way that it's perceived by the public. And that's going to make a big difference when it comes time to having public support for major structural reforms regarding the Supreme Court and, frankly, legislation, as far as I'm concerned.
Agreed entirely. And, you know, I've been torn on this Amy Coney Barrett situation because I agree with you that, you know, I read the Gentleson op-ed as well and was persuaded by it. And he is an expert on the workings of the Senate. And, he sort of poured cold water on some of the other things that people were talking about, saying, no, you know, Mitch can do this or he cannot do that or whatever. And I kind of trust him to be giving an accurate view of what's possible. And so, you know, it did seem to me like doing any of those things, any or all of the things that he recommended made good sense. Then, you know, I hear this other stuff where people are saying, well, maybe you need to use it as a platform to, you know, every single question is the same one to Amy Coney Barrett. Will you recuse yourself? You know, will you recuse yourself from any case that comes before you on the election, and make it very, very clear over and over and over again that that's why Trump wants her on the court, which of course is the case. I mean, he's rushing it through because he's expecting, he says it. There's no mystery here. He says, I need 9 people on the court because, you know, 4-4 wouldn't be good because, you know, I don't trust Roberts. I mean, he hasn't said that, but right. Nonetheless, he's pretty much made it clear that he expects her to vote in his favor, that he expects that this is going to go to the Supreme Court. You know, whether it does, we don't even know. But just the mere fact that he is doing this should be enough to, you know, disqualify this person and just prove and show over and over again that this is the reason that they're putting her on the court. Now, I know they want to talk about the ACA. They want to talk about abortion, you know, all the normal things. And I get that. But to me, in any hearing, if they decide to hold hearings, it should just simply be about the election, about how he's trying to steal it and put her on the court in order to steal it, just in preparation for what he's doing. But on the other hand, you know, I almost feel, you know, that they should just boycott it, not go, and, you know, make it clear that this is just a Republican thing all the way along, and, you know, deny them quorums, take them off the campaign trail, as you say, make those senators like Gardner and Ernst and you know, but Susan Collins and the rest of them who are in trouble, make them come in and spend time in Washington instead of being out on the campaign trail where they want to be. You know, I don't know what the answer to that is, and I guess we'll see this unfold. But, I mean, this is this is not Trump. Trump's just that, you know, he's the Grover Norquist says, you know, we just need a president with the working digits to hold a pen.
Yep.
And he's right. And that's what Trump is in this situation. He struts around like he did something special, but he just happened to be lucky in the sense that he was there.
Yep.
When, you know, people died and when Mitch was the Senate majority leader and could manipulate this whole thing. This is Mitch McConnell. This is the Republican Party. This is the Federalist Society. This is the entire GOP establishment who are sitting there. I mean, you know, there are some never Trumpers who are against this. I've seen them, the Rick Wilson, the Lincoln Project people who have been agitating against Barrett. But they're kind of few and far between too. A lot of the never Trumpers are being very quiet about this one.
Of course.
So, you know, you gotta look at this and recognize that this is an ongoing problem that won't be solved merely by getting rid of Trump. This is something that they have to do those fundamental reforms because we have a rogue political party and they have decided that they will do anything to maintain their hold on this minority rule, which is essentially what they are, and has been becoming more and more obvious ever since Bush versus Gore, right? I mean,
right.
That was the first sort of salvo that showed us what they were capable of. And we saw, you know, you get a minority rule, and the next thing you know, they're starting wars, right? I mean, you know, this is how they go. So, you know, I think, you know, with the Supreme Court, to me, the seating of her is the argument for expanding the Supreme Court. And however they can make that argument stick as being an illegitimate choice and that they have to reverse it by, you know, rebalancing the court in an appropriate way that reflects the wishes of the people of the country, I think that they have to do that. So I'm not sure. You know, I mean, others know better than I about the best Senate strategy. I got to tell you, though, I'm not really confident that Chuck Schumer and Dianne Feinstein are the right people to be doing that.
I'll tell you something. The fact that Dianne Feinstein already blew it once with Amy Coney Barrett,
yep,
did not have the ability to make a nuanced argument that was based upon Coney Barrett's own argument in a law review article. that someone with her deep beliefs, not necessarily about Catholicism, but about any, you know, sort of deeply held religious canon, must recuse themselves in circumstances where that canon would is so essential to their worldview that they wouldn't be able to adjudicate fairly. In other words, you know, and you don't necessarily, it doesn't even necessarily need to be religious. I mean, I think her argument is that if you have a fundamental belief that the, and she argued this specifically about the death penalty, that the death penalty is wrong, then you should not be adjudicating whether someone deserves the death penalty because you aren't capable of doing that. Now, people can argue back and forth as to whether that is a sound principle. I'm not sure it is or it isn't, but that's her argument. And we know her principles. It came out this week that she had signed a document, an ad, basically calling for criminal charges against people who perform abortions. That it was, you know, she, it doesn't get any more fundamental than that for her. But I don't think that Dianne Feinstein is the person to do this. And nor do I think Chuck Schumer is. And frankly, look, if Chuck Schumer is going to say that this process is illegitimate, so illegitimate that I will not meet with Amy Coney Barrett, then it seems to me you have chosen your path. And I don't think any Democrats should show up there, because if you show up there, it becomes about the qualifications of Amy Coney Barrett. If you do not show up there, it becomes about the fairness of the and the legitimacy of the process. Right. I mean, that is. There is no, you cannot have it both ways. It's either one of those things or the other. And the truth is, what I would have probably done is said, we're not meeting with her. We're not attending. This process is a sham. Period. End of story. You could bring in Merrick Garland at this point, and it still would be a sham. Right.
Like,
I mean, that is.
And they could say it that way. I don't care who it is you bring in right now.
Right.
People are already voting.
In the same way that you did not care who the nominee was. It was just from President Obama, and it was during an election year. It's the exact same dynamic for us. We're not going in there. Now, with that said, everyone knows what Amy Coney Barrett stands for. She stands for ending a woman's sovereignty over her own body. When it comes to the question of abortion, and maybe other things, too, for that matter. We also know that Amy Coney Barrett believes that the ACA is unconstitutional, and this is going to be an opportunity for the Republicans to take away your health care. We know these things. We don't need to discuss them with her. We all read her record, but we will not participate in this. And it seems to me then you can have your cake. You can eat it, too. And you can set up what you're going to be doing 3 or 4 months from now. This is the one thing the Democrats never seem to do. They never, ever, ever take the opportunity to exact a political toll in losing fights.
Right. And I agree with you 100%.
And they are fundamentally allergic to it. And I don't know. They sacrifice that. They sacrificed that value proposition for making it look like they gave it a college try. And the fact is that no one believes that they can stop this.
Exactly.
All they can do is exact a political price, but you need to make that choice, right? I mean, it's almost like, for you know, prior to 2004, a Red Sox fan, they would never have a rebuilding year. And so they never, ever could build a team that was strong enough to win. And they could never have a rebuilding year because they wanted to keep the fans engaged just enough. And on some level, that just seems to be the Democrats' perspective on these things. And I know it's something that you and I bemoaned for years. And, you know, this generation of Democrats who practice politics that way, they're at the end of their tenure. And and I believe this is a lesson that the younger generation of Democrats has learned and fundamentally approaches these fights in a very, very different way. And I cannot wait for that era to begin. But for that era to begin, this era needs to end. And it should be ended in a way that is hopefully, constructive. But Heather, speaking of end, we are at the end of our time. As always, it is always a huge pleasure to discuss these things with you. And, well, we'll do it again next week.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Sam. And you've convinced me, by the way, on the holding out on the Democrats on Barrett. They shouldn't attend. I'm convinced.
Boom. One down, an entire Democratic Senate caucus to go. Appreciate it, Heather.
Thanks for having me.
Terrorists, human traffickers, drug dealers, as well as other nefarious people have been funneling dirty money through the banking system for years. Banks are required to report abnormal transactions to the government, but their efforts have fallen flat due to the government's inability, desire, or ability to hold them accountable. Here to discuss his multi-part piece, The FinCEN Files, BuzzFeed's Jason Leopold. So, Jason, let's first off, and what you've done in the work that you've been doing, and you just told me it's been 2 years in the making, and this is one of those stories that is going to be, I mean, this is really the story about how you're going to hear, and I mean you individually, but you, the listening public and the reading public, how you're going to hear possibly dozens, if not even more than that, stories in the weeks and months to come because of the treasure trove of documents that you have secured. Tell us what these documents are and how you got them.
Sure. Well, let me answer the latter question first. I can't talk about sources and methods, so I'm going to have to decline to answer any questions about how we got them. But what I can say is that these are documents known as suspicious activity reports. And suspicious activity reports are documents that banks file with the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN. And FinCEN is the agency within Treasury that combats money laundering, terrorist financing, and other financial crimes. So under the law, banks are obligated to file what's known as suspicious activity reports with FinCEN whenever they detect transactions that may bear the hallmarks of money laundering or other related financial crimes.
Okay, so, you know, examples that we have seen, I think there was someone who released a SAR on Donald Trump earlier this year, but SARs are the things, like, what are the things that trigger SARs? Like, I mean, I know that if I remember correctly, I should say that, you know, taking out $9,999 or something triggers one of these things, right? Because banks have to report any withdrawals of $10,000 worth of cash. And if someone's doing $9,999, it suggests that maybe they're doing that to avoid triggering, a normal reporting. Is that right?
Well, that's actually something different. That's known as a CTR. A cash transaction report, and that's completely separate. So a cash transaction report is something that automatically is filed whenever you're making withdrawals, deposits, whenever you're moving $10,000.
Right.
So that's totally separate. A suspicious activity report is basically, as I mentioned, it's not evidence of a crime, but it is information that banks collect on, you know, transactions, as I mentioned, that bear the hallmarks of money laundering, terrorist financing, or other financial crimes, and they provide that to FinCEN, and that is something that can be used by law enforcement, you know, to
initiate an investigation.
Yeah.
Okay.
So to give you a good example here, back in 2013 and even earlier, banks were filing SARs on Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign manager. So many SARs on Paul Manafort for a wide range of financial allegations of financial misdeeds. Nothing was done. I mean, there was perhaps some from what I've seen in some of these records, some inquiries made. Nothing was done about what they were looking at until after he became Trump's campaign manager. And that's the essence of what our reporting is here, is that for 2 years, what we found are, you know, these suspicious financial transactions that lay bare some real nefarious activity in the banks who, you know, that facilitate it, you know, facilitating the work of terrorists, kleptocrats, and drug kingpins, and the U.S. government not doing anything about it. So we spent 2 years reporting this out, taking these transactions and reporting it all out, and actually doing the job that the agency, the U.S. government agency, had not done at all.
Okay. All right. So the banks have a set of criteria that essentially, you know, ring an alarm bell internally that then requires them to fill out this report and send it to the government. Give me a sense of like how well now your what you have now is really just is it's not not just is the product of the banks sort of somewhat policing themselves on some level. They don't have the ability to really investigate this, but they do have the ability of like, hey, this seems suspicious. How do we have a sense? And tell me, please, if this is out of the scope of your reporting.
Sure.
Do we have a sense of how effective the banks are at this? Because I'm just remembering that I think it's the HSBC story of that. I think it was that bank, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they had like a window in Mexico where they had to reshape
that's
it.
The bank.
They had to reshape
that's
it.
The bank.
They had to reshape it so they would take. So they could take these these suitcases of cash. I mean, that to me sort of says like, hey, this is a little weird. Like, do we know that the bank in that instance, maybe not specifically, but maybe you know specifically, did they file a SARS on something like that? You know, or is that not part of this story? Like the failure of banks to do their part is not part of this. What we're talking about is downstream from that when the government gets these flags and doesn't do anything.
So as far as what the, you know, what it, first of all, let me just say that HSBC, yes, we wrote about HSBC. We provided some brand new information on what HSBC was doing after they entered into what's known as a deferred prosecution agreement with the government for the very crimes that you just raised. I actually can't say whether they filed any SARs on that particular incident, but that's exactly what they are supposed to file SARs on. And we do have, you know, other examples here of where other banks, you know, did that, right? So one of the other things in addition to money laundering, combat, you know, or detecting money laundering, it's actually doing business with countries that are under U.S. sanctions, that they're, you know, like HSBC, other banks are not supposed to be doing business with individuals and entities that, you know, may connect to Iran. You know, for example, we found in one of our, you know, one of our records here, one of our SARs, Standard Chartered moved money on behalf of Al Zaruni Exchange. It's a Dubai-based business that was later accused of laundering cash on behalf of the Taliban. And during the years that Al Zaruni was a Standard Chartered customer, you know, Taliban militants, they stage, you know, all these attacks. So not trying to connect those two, but essentially saying that like that, those are some of the things that, you know, that we found. In the case of HSBC, after they paid a record $1.9 billion fine to the U.S. government for laundering money for Mexican drug cartels and terrorists, we found a number of things that they were doing that they shouldn't have been doing after telling the government that they were going to clean up its act. That included moving money and flagging for the Treasury Department suspicious transactions and moving money as part of a Ponzi scheme. So I realize as I'm speaking about this, that this is so complex.
Yeah.
But,
well,
you know,
so let me
what,
just,
what,
yeah, you know. But I mean, that's what I'm trying to just sort of like, you know, explain to people straightforward. So in that instance, HSBC is, they are actually sending SARs on activities that they're involved with that are clearly stuff that they said that they wouldn't do after they had paid a fine for doing other, you know, nefarious things. taking right. huge cash money that the, you know, should have set off alarm bells. So when they send a SARS, does that decrease their liability in some fashion, or is it just yeah. like, okay, so they do this, they're just covering their themselves because they must know that like FinCEN doesn't really do anything about this stuff. So if we do our part and say, hey, this is suspicious, even though they know like this is more than suspicious, I'm speaking hypothetically, they feel like, okay, we've indemnified ourselves.
That's exactly right. In fact, it's referred to as the banking industry as a defensive filing. I mean, banks don't want to be fined for failing to file suspicious activity reports. So what happens is that the, you know, under the Bank Secrecy Act, this 50-year-old law essentially made, you know, turned banks into a critical component in the fight against money laundering. And then in 1990, when they required banks to file these suspicious activity reports, banks fear getting fined. So they are constantly filing these documents. And what happens is it ends up going to FinCEN, right, which is really understaffed. And they're filing them by the millions. I mean, millions of these documents end up at FinCEN on an annual basis. And they just don't have enough personnel, you know, to read everything. So it ends up going into a database. And this is a database that houses, you know, hundreds of millions of records in addition to the SARS. And first of all, let me just also note that SARS, you know, what makes this kind of unique is that this is the first time that the public is ever really getting an opportunity to see SARS. These are the type of documents that are marked law enforcement sensitive, but they've never been revealed before. You're not allowed to disclose to the subject whether they are the subject of a SAR. You're not allowed to disclose the existence of a SAR. They're not, you virtually can't subpoena SARs. So they're highly coveted and very secretive. And so what we found is that, okay, here are 2,100 SARs that we received. And of these 2,100 SARs, it looks like that nobody ever followed up on these transactions. So we started to report it out. And what we found is some real bad activity, to kind of put it, you know, mildly here, about the ways in which the banks have been facilitating the, you know, drug kingpins, kleptocrats, oligarchs, you know, how dirty money has been flowing in and out of the global economy through, you know, through these banks, you know, in U.S. dollars.
So, all right. So, Jason, forgive me, but I'm cynical, and I'm the type of person that if I had a bank and yeah. I was doing all of these type of things that I know is, you know, is dubious. And in fact, in some instances, like, I'm not an idiot. I know when the guy comes in with a briefcase full of money, like, that's atypical of a, you know, whatever. I'm getting the sense that maybe when he comes in with, like, you know, a couple of bodyguards and he tells me that he has, he has a model shop and he sells models. It's just that it's all in cash and it's a tremendous mm-hmm. amount of money. I know what's going on, but look, this is helpful for my bank. I'm going to cover myself by sending in a SARS about this, but I'm also going to send in 100 other SARS from that day that I think are, you know, maybe they're suspicious, maybe they're not, but I'm going to send in a bunch because I know if I send in one SARS and it's about something with the guy coming in with a bunch of money and he supposedly owns like a little model shop, but it's clear he's not getting the money from that, that could get some scrutiny. But if I send in 101 SARS on that day from everything, you know, from a bunch of customers I have, the chances of that really nefarious one being caught or found or studied or investigated is much less. Is that what's going on here?
I can't say that is actually going on, where the banks are actually saying, let's just flood the system, because if we send in that one SAR, then FinCEN's going to look at it. I think that what we found is definitely some instances where there may have been what's referred to as over-reporting, but you know, it sounded like, to your point that you were trying to make, is that they kind of knew that there may have been some illicit, you know, that these transactions were, you know, involving some sort of illicit activity, and they're filing the SARs, continuing to move the money. And that's actually what's happening. You know, what's happening is that the banks, they suspect this, the compliance officers suspect it, they're filing this FinCEN, but they also aren't getting any feedback. And that's actually been one of the complaints where, you know, the banks have said, hey, you're not telling us how, whatever happened with that SAR we filed on El Chapo. So,
right.
And by the way, that's, you know, almost exactly what happened here. So what we found, though, at least in the records we have, is that the banks approved $2 trillion, you know, for the most part, $2 trillion of suspicious transactions, even though there were all these warnings. So we didn't find anything where, you know, there's instances where law enforcement would say, you know, keep an account open so we can follow this nefarious activity. I think there may have been one or two instances in all of these SARs that we have. But yet their staff is warning that these transactions might be related to crime. And we're not talking, by the way, I want to make it clear, it's not as if, Sam, you know, you're going to your local, you know, Bank of America or Wells Fargo and you deposit some money and it's like, oh, is Sam Sater, you know, laundering money? No, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in, you know, individual transactions. We're talking about people like Paul Manafort, Viktor Yanukovych, you know, of Ukraine. I mean, real, real high profile figures here. So this is not, you know, your mom and pop sort of bank, or savings or you know, an individual,
right,
that's just cashing money. This is a lot of money.
These are transactions that stick out, that people in the bank can't even pretend that they're not aware of, because this is the stuff that drives their business. So when they
let me give you a little, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, when they file the SARs, do they get criminal indemnification? Because my sense is, and I've talked to attorneys in the past who have tracked, let's say, terrorist funding through banks or through other entities.
Right.
And when they find out about it, they have civil actions that they can take. I'm going to sue on behalf of the victims of these terrorism, or I'm going to sue on behalf of the victims of these crimes. But these SARs are secret. They should be, or theoretically are, until an enterprising journalist reports this stuff out. And if it indemnifies them in terms of criminal activity, they send it to the government. They're safe on that accord. If it's secret, which it is, then they're safe in terms of like a civil suit. I mean, is that what's going on here? These guys, they send it in there and they know, like, okay, as long as the government doesn't tell us to stop doing what we may or may not know is illegal, then it's okay.
That that sounds pretty accurate. Yes. I mean, so it's not as if they're sending it in and they're saying, hey, we're going to take at least what we found. We're going to be proactive and just shut down this account. No, they're not doing that at all. It's essentially like they're filing these SARs. They're not hearing anything back from FinCEN or, frankly, FBI or other law enforcement. And so they continue to just move the money. And it, in some cases, maybe it is financing, you know, IEDs or drug cartels are laundering their money and the banks are facilitating that. And that's essentially what we found.
So in the 2000 or so SARs that you have acquired, do you know, and do we know, that these haven't been handpicked because they're the most suspicious or the most obvious of the SARs that come in? Or are these sort of like, here's a random tranche that came in, this month or something like that?
So let me give you some background as to why we have these.
Okay.
And I think that may help answer your question. So back in 2017, way, way back, which feels like 10 years ago, when a handful of congressional committees started investigating Donald Trump and the Russia's interference in the 2016 election, they started to look at, and actually they were trying to follow the money, right? What role did money play in, if any, you know, in this, you know, what the, at the time, what the allegations were related to Russia's interference. So they looked to Treasury and they asked Treasury, whether they could pull any SARs on specific individuals and entities. And these individuals and entities included people like Paul Manafort, Felix Sater. It included Christopher Steele, who was the you know, the former MI6 dossier author, and Deutsche Bank, right? Because Deutsche Bank has a connection with Trump. So 160 individuals and entities. And Treasury pulled all of these SARs from its database. In some instances, they even went to some banks and say, if you have anything on these individuals, send it over. So that collection, right, we started to look at. We didn't find anything, you know, that was connected to, you know, the election and financing, you know, whatever election interference. But because the searches that Treasury and FinCEN had conducted were so broad, what it revealed is something that, you know, Congress wasn't even looking for, which is the basis of what we reported over the past 2 years, which is evidence that, you know, the world's biggest banks, you know, continued to do business with clients, with people, with that they suspected were facilitating terror and corruption. And it was all revealed in these, you know, in these transactions, and it was there the whole time, and no one ever looked further into it, and not even members of Congress.
Is this the policy of, like, I mean, is the FinCEN, is this a situation where they're like, look, we don't have the resources for to deal with each one of these SARs that come in, so what we're going to do is we're just going to keep it here, and it's like a secondary, it's, we just have a library. And if and in situations where investigations are happening and people want to see if there's something, because we should remind people that, you know, like money laundering and this and that, those are second order crimes insofar as that, like, they you engage in money laundering because you've done something criminal and you need to hide the you need to hide the what you've made from that criminal activity. And so you need to money launder, and that's what's happening, right? And so is that, I mean, is FinCEN, I guess I should put it this way, is FinCEN, is this contrary to their mission, or is it just like they're incapable of fulfilling their mission? Like, did they ever contemplate, like, we're not actually going to be able to pursue any of this stuff, so we're just going to keep it in case somebody else needs it for a specific person? Or are they like, We can't even fulfill our mission, or what? Like, where is?
I think there's some truth to a little bit of truth to that, and you know, here's essentially what I, you know, what I found, you know, during the course of this investigation, is that, one, the U.S. government, as you know, Sam, loves to to collect intelligence information on people, on citizens, right, and there is a lot of info here. In fact, you know, we spoke to former FBI agent Mike German, and you know, he's now a, you know, a national security and privacy expert, and he actually said that, you know, after 9/11, the SAR program, you know, at least this is what he believes, is that the SAR program became more about mass surveillance than identifying discrete transactions to disrupt money launderers. So the U.S. government is collecting all of this information from banks, and of course they can't read anything, but it goes into this database where then they can mine it for, you know, perhaps for other purposes. And so there are instances where some other government agencies, you know, they'll look for patterns in, you know, a bunch of different SARs, and, you know, perhaps there's, you know, drug cartels and on the border, and they're looking, you know, the DEA is looking to dismantle it. They may, you know, again, they try to follow the money. They'll look for various patterns to see how money is moving. But, you know, they know that they don't have enough staff to look through millions of SARs that they get on a yearly. So it becomes something that they end up just collecting. And, you know, it really did escalate after 9/11. And it even escalated after this HSBC case that you brought up in 2012, because this was such a damning case that showed how HSBC really had been facilitating terrorists and drug.
So let's say if I was a lawmaker and I said, like, you know, this is bad. We need to actually act upon these things, not just sort of keep a running tab that nobody checks in with in terms of, like, you know, this money moving around and money laundering and whatnot. And I called you up and I said, Jason, you seem to know about this stuff. Where is the failure point? Like, what do we need to do if we actually want to get serious about changing the behavior, getting banks to stop doing money laundering, let's say, because it is financing too many bad things? What would you recommend they do based upon your knowledge of the system as it works?
Oh, that's a good question. That's also a hard question, Sam, because there's so many different answers. And, you know, one thing that obviously needs to be done, and that we've highlighted here, is that when the banks are caught, when, you know, they're engaging in this type of helping to facilitate, rather, these transactions, that ultimately what happens is that they get slaps on the wrist, you know. So there's no accountability in the form of holding individuals accountable. So let me use the case of HSBC again, right? HSBC, you know, ends up in this what's known as a deferred prosecution agreement. They pay a $1.9 billion fine. They promise to clean up its act. They get appointed an independent monitor, you know, this internal watchdog who essentially is supposed to make sure that they, you know, that they have all their, you know, systems and computer programs to detect money laundering in place over the course of 5 years. 5 years goes by, as we reported, and they still are unable to do that. And they're still, you know, moving suspicious transactions. And so the government simply says, okay, the deferred prosecution agreement is over, right, at the end of 2017, because that's what they did. You met all your obligations. But guess what happens the following month in January 2018? Well, HSBC enters into another deferred prosecution agreement for a different set of, you know, financial crime. And the next year, in 2019, they enter into another deferred prosecution agreement. So after our story came out, was published about a week ago, you know, Elizabeth Warren, she put out a statement, and she essentially said that, look, you know, this is the reason that Congress needs to pass legislation that she introduced in 2018 called Ending the Too Big to Jail Act, right? Which, you know, she says would hold Wall Street executives criminally accountable when the banks break the law. And, you know, Bernie Sanders also, you know, described what we reported as, you know, the routine business practices on Wall Street. And, you know, so as far as the industry is concerned, they're saying maybe they should report fewer SARs. Maybe they should focus on the type of transactions that instead of flagging every single thing that they see as suspicious, maybe they should just, you know, zero in on specific ones that they feel, you know, deserve more attention. Maybe, you know, they're proposing that they get more feedback about, you know, what they're writing in what's known as the narrative as to what they're seeing. So there's lots of discussion, and these discussions and these and efforts to lobby for change have been going on for years. And, you know, Ron Wyden, by the way, you know, he actually told us that first he said that there's two systems of law enforcement justice in the country. You know, drug cartels move money and, you know, poor people go to jail for possession.
Right.
But one of the things that we found here was that, you know, the ways in which money launderers are able to do this is because there are shell companies that banks don't know the true owner of a certain company, and they're still moving money. And there is legislation to try to end that. So there's lots of answers, Sam. You know, lots of ways in which this can be tackled. I think that what we were hoping that what people would see is like, here is this just a sampling, 2,100 suspicious activity reports that have never before been revealed, that we spent 2 years reporting out, and we actually found that the transactions were suspicious. But then when we reported it out, we found what they were actually doing and how nobody was following it up. So, and we were just not even as, I mean, I think we actually had, because we shared this with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists,
right,
that worked the Panama Papers. So we actually had more personnel than FinCEN.
Wow.
You know, that
we as a society, and certainly our government, is serious about stopping this, because A, we're not obviously allocating the resources to respond to the self-reporting that the banks are doing. And even when we do, we're not punishing them for being repeated offenders of doing this work. And it also sounds to me like there's got to be a higher level of responsibility to the banks than just reporting stuff that is like clearly problematic, because that reporting just gets them off. And I think they perceive that as a get out of jail free card, or not even head to jail free card, essentially, that they're filing. So, Jason, can
we reported that. I just want to know two things, Sam. One, we did report that about the get out of jail free card. The government doesn't have any obligation to force the banks to shut down the accounts. That's on the banks. But let me make, if I can just say one important point here. We reached out to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network and Treasury about a month before we published. And we let them know what, sent them a long list of questions. Here's what we were going to report. Here's what we were going to say. We sought responses from them. On September 1st, FinCEN released a statement, posted it on its website. It's still there on the front page of its website, FinCEN.gov, that said that the agency had become aware that certain media outlets were going to be reporting on suspicious activity reports. FinCEN then, this statement then went on to say that the disclosure of these records is illegal, potentially threatens national security, and that they referred the matter to the Department of Justice and their own internal watchdog for investigation. So that's what happened after we, sought answers from the U.S. Treasury Department.
So instead of, let me just, if I understand this correctly, so instead of actually pursuing the red flags that get sent into their office because they don't have the time, they spent time pursuing the people who made it clear that they're not pursuing the red flags.
For this instance, it would seem that way. I mean, I'm sure, look, I should note that FinCEN puts out or posts on their website what they call SAR success stories. And those success stories show like how SARs were used in various, prosecutions and law enforcement investigations, but nothing on the level of this. We're talking like mom and pop type transactions. We are not talking about Paul Manafort, Viktor Yanukovych, or Dmitry Firtash, real Oleg Deripaska. I mean, we're not talking about those individuals, right? Or
there's
other entities.
There's an analogy here with the IRS. We have cut the ability for the IRS to audit very wealthy people because they don't want to get involved with lawyers, so they go after poor people. and it sort of
and they count it as a win.
Yep. Well, all right, Jason, so are we going to see a bunch more stories that are going to come out, specific stories about this now? Okay, so folks should keep your eyes open from stories that are coming from Jason, I would imagine from other reporters too, who you guys shared the documents with, because they're going to dig in and they're going to follow each one of these 2,000 some odd SARs are its own potential narrative that will be pursued and hopefully reported out. And we may be, you know, this could be one of those situations, and you tell me if I'm wrong, that we're going to be reading about stories that come from this trove that you have secured for months, years. I mean, we're going to be seeing these stories. We're going to see one of these things are going to come out, drip, 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 right?
Yeah, you know, and part of it is, part of the reason for that is that we are, it takes quite an investment of time to, you know, to report it out. So yes, is the answer.
Well, Jason, it's fascinating stuff. We will put a link to your original BuzzFeed story from which a lot of stories are going to come. Congratulations again. This is a really big achievement from reporting wise and writing wise. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Sam. Thanks so much.
Jason Leopold is a senior investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News. He's based in Los Angeles. He is the 2018 Pulitzer finalist for international reporting. That's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. A special thank you to all of our free podcast subscribers that converted into supporters of this program this week. We really appreciate it. And if you're listening and you are a free listener and you want to support this show, you would be doing us both a big favor. Head over to rofpodcast.com. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more and check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire. Getting that we need it all easier when they don't.